words before I was a dead duck. I hit the man with my book. Adams, Criminal Law and Practice in New Zealand. I lost the cover. I did not hang about. 2 weeks later, I found myself as a member of the Criminal Law Reform Committee in Wellington. Timorously, I told my Newmarket story, my debut on Broadway, to the assembled silks and justices. Silence. Then a chortle, and a chorus of chortles. Judges don't laugh, they chortle. Even the fiercely named Savage and Wild, and Spite and Roper. One suggested I go off with the parliamentary draftsman. Get that definition down to something succinct and memorizable. We returned with 29 words. Our text sprang from a 1920 dictum in the American Supreme Court by Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes. I quote, "Detached reflection cannot be demanded in the presence of an uplifted knife." I knew that. Psychological realism in a nutshell. Our 29 words still stand in place of those 363. The absurdism and absurdists I have instanced hit their targets. Why? Because the targets were causes, not persons. David Lowe abhorred fascism. Woodhouse couldn't stand bully boy magistracies and employers who didn't care about worker safety. John Clark was bemused by Olympic bureaucrats who couldn't measure 100 metres. Lord Acton was angered by war jingoism. It is a thin line between effective satire and personal invective. There is daily invective and scorn directed against the president of a very powerful nation. That employed by his stung compatriots has been as coarse as what and as who provoked it. A film star, for instance, asked an audience, "When was the last time an actor assassinated a president?" The difference between that and, say, John Clark's and Atkins and Woodhouse's dicta is that theirs all attacked the power abusers through a cause. The cause in today's America could be healthcare, racial justice, or climate change, or preferably all of them. At last, a metaphor for the world. In 1953, in the Christian Science Monitor, Archibald MacLeish, lawyer-poet, said the world could be saved by a metaphor. Long before that, we had been told that poets are the world's unacknowledged legislators. Now, in my ninth decade, I am still looking for a palpable statutory hit by a poet. Certainly there are poems that should have shocked warmongers. I think of Randell Jarrell's terrible images of hosing out the remains of a tail gunner from a B-29, and some searing World War I testimonies and later books like The Tin Drum. But they have not saved humanity from recidivistic slaughterers. Our most vivid language comes from Shakespeare, but I don't think he belonged to or opposed any international salvation army. Rather, he aimed Book Tudor and Jacobean bums on seats. Consciences could follow. I do have 2.5 candidates for MacLeish's claim. But first, let's examine the subject. The metaphor, that is the metaphor. Grass's drum is a book, not a figure of speech or a single image. Similarly, Evelyn Waugh, also Fane Weldon's novel The Shrapnel Academy, though its title might just scrape in. A British civil servant examined public service metaphors in the 1950s and helpfully reported that a live metaphor is one that evokes a picture of the imagery of its origin. It evokes the picture of the imagery of its origin. For example, Eliot's Fretful Sleepers, borrowed by Bill Pearson for his 1951 Landfall article. The bureaucratic examples were humdrum: blueprint, bottleneck, ceiling, glass ceiling, etc. Some metaphors were said to be born tired, like the poet as legislator of the world. But a newly minted one shines, a jewel in a drab vocabulary. H.G. Wells's Mr. Polly knew that and revelled in his polysyllabic verbo juices. I suspect our local hero, A.R.D. Fairbairn, kept abreast via Porsche with his hasty mug of tea at Mercer Station on the overnighter with "The squalid tea of Mercer is not strained." Though the wordplay is a bit. Still, in the 1950s, we were kept breathless by Dylan Thomas's Milkwood, from which images spilled so freely. Janet Frame's Talk of Treasure gave us equally rich embroidery, but with inbuilt restraint. I give you pea-green lush of grass, swarm of insects dizzily hitting the high spots, dunny rosette creeping, covering shawl cream in a knitted cosy of roses. Ah, the tipsy wee small hours of insects that jive upon the crippled grass blades and the face of the first flower alive. And I planted carrot seed that never came up, for the wind breathed a blow-away spell. I dare not give you any more in the presence of the CLL. Out of the uniformed services, I gasped. I'd been in the Air Force. The RAF, after the wizard 1980s, had nothing to offer except my particular job at the controls of a mahogany bomber. A desk. So, friends, patient listeners, and fretful sleepers, at this point, Archie McNeish butts in with, "What about the metaphor to save the world?" David Longies at Oxford promised much. And as he said about the Rainbow Warrior sabotage, you can sink a ship, but you cannot kill a rainbow. Otherwise, I have encountered very few contenders. One, a technological recipe by Yuval Noah Harari, I have noted on your hymn sheet under Homo Deus. It is not pretty enough to vocalize. Scientists, especially astrophysicists, excite us with their imagery. Gravitational wave signals, the cooking of heavy elements, the violent merging of black holes in deep space with a resulting chirp, which I used to think was a big bang. Einstein in 1915 alluded to gravity curving space, which he likened, with us in mind, to a blind beetle moving on a curved surface. But a wise advisor on metaphor demurs on two grounds. The image of the beetle won't save anything and doesn't pretend to. Secondly, it's not a metaphor, it's a simile. Einstein's E equals mc squared is a beautifully eloquent equation, relativity speaking, but it is not a metaphor. So in the words of the immortal bard, whose identity eludes me, it could be old Winston, "We've got the snaffle and curb all right, but where's the bloody horse?" I grasp a tired straw from my civil service man, and find a horse of a different colour. A Russian major, one Stanislav Petrov, who died last month. In late 1978, Petrov's words, a phrase, actually did save the world. On his surveillance screen, the major picked up a swarm of missiles approaching the USSR, target Moscow. Did he press the button? No. He uttered and entered the two words, standard malfunction. The missiles turned out to be a trick of the sun. So it was not a metaphor that saved the world. It was a bureaucratic cliché. Finally, for the time is very close to 13 o'clock, all time. While the sciences use words, including magical ones like stardust and four-dimensional fabric of time-space, we, the arts folk and writers, tend to ignore their works, their attitudes. 70 years ago, a disfavored Cambridge chemistry don, C.P. Snow, the writer of many novels, too many, brought out a booklet, Science and Government, and introduced us to the two cultures and the tensions between them. Several of the novels dwelt on the subject. Nothing much came of them. A few planks, no bridges. It isn't too late to start building now. Christine Cole Catley, our mentor and the friend of Janet Frame and the CLC, at 83, researched and wrote the biography of Beatrice Hill Tinsley of New Plymouth and Yale, a genuinely gifted astrophysicist who died at 41. She was also a belletrist, published on the concert program, and a cellist. Dame Christine, at 83, was without formal training in physics. She completed the book, and she coined for the title the metaphor Bright Star. When I spoke with Christine about creative writers and the scientists, she said that in extremis, they do pull together. When Penn knew a patient at Seacliff Hospital had won the Hubert Church Award, it acted fast to inform the medical scientists there, such as they were, to inform them of the win. They straightway abandoned the lobotomy scheduled for Janet Frame. The pen may not always be mightier than the scalpel, but it was allowed to be decisive on that occasion. It took both cultures to save New Zealand's most potent and vivacious literary imagination. For all that, it was David Longley in that smoke hole Oxford room with his smelling the uranium on your breath, sir, who came closest to meeting MacLeish's challenge. His famous line illuminated our part of the world and sent a signal to the rest. Shamefully, yet a would-be New Zealand Prime Minister was reported in 2006 at the time of Longley's funeral to say of the nuclear-free Pacific, it'll be gone by breakfast. That is a depressing line to end on. About as bad an end as we now possibly face, as orchestrated by two self-regarding nonsense with bad hairdos. Tweedledee and Tweedledum. As Alice would say, curiouser and curiouser. Thank you.
Bernard. I can't say much more after that to follow. You have done us proud, and I'm sure that there were times when the hairs on the back of my neck were standing up, as if thinking that Janet Frey might be floating around the room somewhere. Please stay. There are some cheese platters outside. Please enjoy yourselves, and thank you very, very much for coming tonight. Thank you.